Thank you for that blessing. It's already put us in tune with the title of Chapter 5, Where Does Your Heart Go? Well, this is not only a good book, it's really all about God, but it turns out to be a living document of the huge shift in our religious culture that has happened in the skin of one man. Muslim, atheist, Jewish, Christian, Samir Salmanovic. Well, it gives us a front row seat for the drama that was announced on Time magazine's cover in 1966. How many of you remember this cover? Yes. It was the first public announcement of the decline of the American church. And on 9/11, another cover from Time announced what became a catalyst for our author's own understanding of the clash of religions when the two towers came down in New York City. He describes the desperate aftermath, the loss of their new church board member, Michael, who was in one of those towers. And his church is in that very neighborhood around Ground Zero, where he found that he was just surrounded by seething anger and distrust. The fact that he had a sort of Middle East cast to his skin and his name was Samir, hey, isn't your name Samir, began to make him realize that something else was about to explode within his own neighborhood. But just at about that time, two women in his congregation suggested that perhaps they should hold a public meeting so that we could really hear what the Muslim religion is about. However, as he first tested the idea, he got no's from all sides. He turned his attention inward and listened to what he calls that still small voice that wouldn't let him go. It just kept burning until he announced that they were going to hold the public meeting. Somehow, everyone was able to speak. All the anger, all the sadness, the truth of the Muslim religion, all of it was expressed within a safe container that crisis temporarily had put around everyone. And for a whole year afterward, he reports about the grace that followed all of his efforts, his church's efforts in downtown New York City. One of his friends says, in a quote in the chapter, you know, it's as if for a whole year we've been living in September the 11th. Tomorrow is September 12th for the first time in 365 days. And yet, after that September the 12th, the old default positions began to re-emerge. They began to solidify. And of course, they were heightened by the media and by politics. Religious traditions proclaiming God and invoking God and yet distrusting and demeaning other faiths, somehow God had gotten lost while they were invoking God. So our author takes a little sideways jaunt and he looks at why religions developed in the first place. He says, you know, they really developed to create systems of meaning about our origin and purpose that linked people together in life-sustaining communities surrounding their sense of God. But today they're at war with each other. But everybody worships something, he says, in the secular world and especially within the religious sphere. What we venerate, what we're the most loyal to, becomes the center of our lives. We protect it. We defend it. It becomes our hearth fire. It becomes the meaning of reality. And truthfully, for the last at least 1,200 years, religion has been the corporate lens through which most of humanity has seen reality. So to sort of establish a ground line here for where he's going to take us for the rest of the chapter, I'd like to break into just a little bit of table talk for about 5 minutes this morning. We're going to do a little brainstorming about religion. And I'm going to ask if you will look at each other around the table. You may want to turn your chairs around just briefly for this so that you can see each other. We're going to be just sitting around our tables doing a little brainstorm about the questions I put up here on the screen. Now, you know what a brainstorm is. It's not a lot of talk. You just pop an idea. You don't explain it. You don't have a long story to go with it. It's just what comes to your mind right then. The idea is that I would like to pile up invisibly on the tables in the middle of you all of your heartfelt ideas about what you value the most within your own religious life. So will somebody just volunteer to be the point person for their table? Raise your hand for me. Let me see. We've got one at each table. Yes, thank you. Somebody over here. Just anybody. If she wants me to do it, I'll do it. All right, good. I'd like that point person to just read the questions aloud. I will read them first for you. And we'll just give you a minute just to pop your responses. And as I hit the gong, you'll just move to the next question. So what we're going to be doing is to respond to what draws you to take part in religious life. Where are your energies going to support your God-related life? What aspects of worship touch you the most? The rituals, the liturgy, the music, the sermons? What settings bring you closest to God? And which doctrines feel vital to your life and to the people around you? So, number one. You don't have to write anything down. We just talk it out very quickly. So, what draws you around the table? Number two. Where are your energies going to support your God-related life? Quick answers. Very good. Let's go to number three. So what aspects of worship touch you the most? Here are some examples. Rituals, liturgy, music, sermons. Number three. Worship. What do you like about worship? Around the tables, please. And wrapping up that round, let's go to number four. Which settings bring you closest to God? Which settings bring you closest to God? 1 minute around your tables. And wrapping up that round, number five, doctrines. Which doctrines feel vital to your life and to the people around you? Doctrines. What's still alive for you? What's still vital for you? Or are there any? Around the tables, 1 minute. Well, thank you very much. That was a good round of quick brainstorming. At least from up here, watching all of you, that looked like a fairly satisfying experience. There were lots of ideas. Certainly, I could see people nodding their heads. I saw a few people shaking their heads. But it's given each table a good sense of the territory of the religious value that you all still feel strongly about. Now, in any other era, you would get very good marks for this work. In fact, this would be evidence of a pious life, well lived. But Samir is asking a different question about religious traditions. What he's asking is, where is the presence of God in all of the proclamations and the things that we say, especially in the public square, about our religious tradition? Is our religion filled with the presence of God, or is it mostly filled with good stuff about God? He makes a very interesting distinction here, and to him, this is the deal-breaking description between two kinds of approaches to religion today. He speaks about the traditional mindsets as narrowing our consciousness down to what Buddhism would call the world of 1,000 objects. God has become object, proper ways of observing and doing things, rather than the deep subject of it all. The Old Testament calls these 1,000 objects idols. Samir calls a spade a spade. Whatever is non-God gets our allegiance is an idol. Even our religion becomes an idol when we use it to acquire territory, power, and influence and call it devotion. The time-honored term for turning away from serving idols to finding the true God is conversion, that old-fashioned word that suddenly has a new vital ring to it in Samir Selmanovic's mind. Now, because we're coming to understand religion as an evolving form of human culture, we can understand the idea of converting over and over again from one stage of consciousness to a higher one. One eminent sociologist of contemporary Christianity sees the breakdown of our churches as the fourth great awakening in Christianity, Diana Butler Bass, who is often here in Santa Barbara. I'm sure that some of you know her. Yes, and she taught here too. Good. Well, we love Diana. Well, Samir uses other terms like conversion, but he's observing the same phenomenon. In the cultural mix of his New York City streets, he sees all the evidences of the stages of Christianity that Paul Smith came and talked to us about 3 years ago. Remember these. On Samir's streets, he sees the fighting warrior stage of terrorist Islamic groups in the headlines daily. He also sees the traditionalist stage with its patriarchal leadership and steady rule-bound conformity that's still alive in a number of churches in New York City. Of course, the modern liberal church is still the mainstream stage of most New York churches. And you see we're going up in color here, getting to the green, while the postmodern stage of the church makes its own headlines regularly by collapsing hierarchies, by embracing the marginalized, and advocating for justice. Samir is calling us to the next stage after that, converting to the stage that he calls the kingdom of God. It's a much more inclusive paradigm. He says it's the God of all existence, which of course makes relatives of all the religions. He says, to say that God has decided to visit all humanity through only one particular religion is a deeply unsatisfying assertion about God. This could only come into print in 2015. This would have been a book for burning even a couple of decades ago. You can see that he is just within his own skin, modeling, living out this big shift. Bruce McLaren, Richard Rohr, Rob Bell, you know, Diana, these are all the writers, the prophets, the ministers who are preaching along similar lines of inclusionary belief. There's a general term for this. It's called the emergent church. It's the beginning of a profound shift from the stage that we're in to the one that's rushing toward us. The term emergent church seems particularly apt if you think of it, as I do, close to the kind of emergent properties that come out of physical processes. Chaos theory, which has been popularized enough so that even little minds like ours can understand it, posits the following, that at some point, things begin to destabilize, patterns begin to get lost, things begin to get perturbated. And out of that kind of disarray, always a new stable pattern arises that is larger than the disarray from which it has come. It emerges just naturally, just organically, out of what it has come from. That is how I view the emerging church. But it is viewed in a great many ways depending upon where you are on that spectrum of evolution and development. When I look at what is arising, I see it a little bit like the brainstorm, like popcorn coming up all over the religious landscape. Believe me, it's not all going to arrive at once. It's not going to be some great announcement in the New York Times about new church policy. It's not going to be an encyclical from a bishop or a pope. No, it's going to be clusters of groups waking up spiritually, finding themselves in an unexpected synergistic alignment with each other. Our author speaks of listening to God rather than telling others about Him. He speaks of keeping an open space where we can receive and hear that small, still voice. Samir alludes to God as something like a spacious place with the energy of divine presence throughout it. Of course, that's deliberately and helpfully imprecise, as he says, because he tells us that the only way to move into direct relationship with that presence is to cultivate awareness and mindfulness and to allow the space around our hearts as a place where God may enter. Now, although that's not a mainstream teaching today, his notion of his heart as the place where God can enter is an old one. Hundreds of years ago, Théophane the recluse said the same thing. Let your mind descend into your heart and remain there. It is the waiting room of the Lord. The science of neurocardiology and a hardy group of researchers at the Institute of Heart Math, which, as some of you know by now, is my favorite think tank, have proven that the mind, in fact, can move into the heart with enormous consequences. The Heart Math folks have condensed their findings into a series of practices that, in a religious setting, would be called spiritual practices. And I'm going to teach you one this morning. It's a 5-minute exercise that's a lot like Samir's 5-minute exercise that he writes about before he goes to bed at night, when he slips into that in-between place where he is still conscious, but he has let go of all the linear, hierarchical kinds of thinking that he's been doing during the day. Now, many of you have been exposed to descriptions of the intelligence of the heart in one way or another in previous lectures that I've given here at Word and Life. But for those who are new to the research, and perhaps as a brief review for the rest of us, let me just run through the facts. The heart, we all know, is the master pump regulating our cardiovascular system. It's also the master oscillator of the entire body. All cells, all atoms, move with the rhythm of the heartbeat. It releases hormones regulating our well-being, for instance, cortisol, oxytocin. But what we haven't known until now is that the heart generates a strong electromagnetic field that permeates through every cell of our body and puts out enough power to extend that electromagnetic field into space. It is densest 3 to 4 feet from our bodies, but it reaches out to about 8 or 10 feet around us. It can be detected by monitoring instruments, but also by animals and other people. It transmits information from the whole of our system through the energy networks of our own EM field. It also picks up information that's resonating in the fields of all other life around us, as well as the planet itself. You're sitting here, I'm sitting here. It looks like empty space between us. But in fact, if I had one of those little black boxes that the Heart Math folks have, I'd be able to go through like a Geiger counter and just go all the way around the room, because we're all emitting these subtle fields. And when we move and align our consciousness, as we're going to do in a minute, you can be a little more privy to the presence of those fields. Now, the heart uploads and downloads information from the other three brains in our head. The fight or flight programs of our oldest brain, which pretty much still run our lives. The emotions, memories, and habit patterns of our mammal brain. The language and thinking of the new brain, the neocortex, which makes us human. Homo sapien, the one who knows himself. Now, the heart has a major highway of transmission to the frontal lobes, right up here, which runs from the heart up through the vagus nerve into those prefrontals. But it only opens up when positive, caring thoughts are being felt in the heart. It closes down when other kinds of thoughts are happening. Most of us live on autopilot under the management system of our base reptilian brain, which runs our existence most of the time. It's when we're operating with a standard sense of minor anxiety, insecurity, a little frustration. It produces a particular heart rate signature. Look at the left side of the screen. And that's what everybody's heart rate basically looks like. Probably not so angular. You all look fairly mellow to me. We're having a good time. So that it won't be quite as shaky if we were actually to see our own heart rates as this is. But it doesn't begin to look like what's happening on the right-hand side. This left-hand side is not unhealthy. It's just limiting. It's the way the sympathetic system runs the show. But when we shift to the right side, to steady, positive feeling, another system entirely takes over. The parasympathetic system, which slows things down. And the heart moves into coherence. This equal trough, high and low, coherence. It's a wonderful, steady state affair. And the instant it moves in, it's like emergence, the emergent properties. The minute it moves into this steady state, its frequencies are so much more powerful than the thinking brain's frequencies that the thinking brain whoosh, immediately entrains to it. So that heart and brain then are in a state of coherence. It can be monitored. There's mathematics to it. It's a real state. Now, suddenly, the brain entrained to the heart is privy to a universe of information that it was never in touch with before. When we are heart coherent, our biological systems are synchronized and in a state of energetic coordination, greater health. In an optimal mental state with heart, mind, and feelings all in sync, we have a truly broadband intelligence that's available to us. And we can access that space that Samir describes in Chapter 5, the space in our hearts and minds where God can enter in, where spirit integrates more fully into being. It is this intuitive, energetic heart state that's associated with the still, small inner voice that goaded Samir to risk that great meeting that changed his life and the life of the church around him. This coherent state is transmitted through our electromagnetic fields to affect and align the incoherent states around us. Research shows that when someone in an ordinary incoherent state, just like us, walks into a room where three other people are actually in a coherent heart state, without a word being said, that fourth person will organically, naturally come into coherence. It's been demonstrated so often now that I think the HeartMath people have devised a tiny small group biofeedback mechanism that actually shows this happening. Now, when several people work together in a coherent state, there's a flow of synchronicity and harmony that produces higher quality achievement. Increasing numbers of people able to sustain heart coherence leads to increased social coherence all around them. Now, in the years that it's been working to understand and document these heart states, the Institute of Heart Math has found evidence that supports a finding of a global energy field. It's in an environment all around the entire Earth that connects all living systems and consciousness. Many of those scientists believe that there is a feedback loop between humans and the Earth's energetic systems that reflect back to us not what we're thinking, but what we're feeling. They can catch evidences of it. They have small stations in various countries around the world that it's difficult for me to explain this, but if you go on site to the HeartMath Institute, you'll see the whole project laid out for you that shows how we're slowly beginning to actually listen to these vast fields and what happens when a little coherence begins to move into them. Now, for the next 5 minutes, I'm going to teach you how to move in to a heart coherent state. It's nothing you haven't done before, but I will simply do it along heart math lines so that while we read it as spiritual exercise, they read this as a lab teaching. So I think you can just stay in your chairs where you are, but if you will simply follow my instructions, we're going to do a 5-minute exercise that is similar to the one that Samir does before he goes to sleep. But it will just be led by a stream of my own instruction. I want you to sit comfortably and we'll begin to breathe deeply. We will breathe what I call the prayer of the three deep breaths. When we breathe mindfully, deeply, just 3 times, the neurochemistry in our brain begins to shift. It's documented. So, if you'll sit easily, close your eyes, and begin to follow a deep breath pattern with me. Now imagine that you're breathing through the space of your heart with each breath. Breath comes in through the heart, goes out through the heart. In through the heart, out through the heart. This is heart-focused breathing. Now generate a feeling of appreciation within yourself and feel it as strongly as you can within the arena of your heart. The good things in your life, the animal that you love, this wonderful group, the morning's coffee, a deep feeling of appreciation that is warming your heart. And on each breath now, feel your heart warming a little more and a little more. More and more energy. More than it can contain. Imagine that it spreads out now with each breath to embrace your whole body. Radiating a circle of positive feeling that reaches out now and engages the field of the persons next to you. Sustain that positive feeling and with the next breath allow it to radiate out even further into the room. Your entire table is wrapped in these energetic circles.
And now let it radiate out to fill the entire room. And as your own heart and mind take you, follow it where the radiation moves, perhaps to the entire church. Sustain it with this feeling of appreciation. Don't let the ideas of the mind stop or make you stumble at all. Just keep that strong feeling going. And now with that expanded field still humming and intact, bring your attention back to your own center and hold your heart's energy with a moment of thanksgiving for this instant, for this opportunity to be here together. You may want to physically place your hand over your heart just as a final blessing, as a final gesture to stabilize this coherence for more than a moment. And then come back into the room, into your body. And as you open your eyes, allow a soft gaze. It's the way artists learn to see, without the mind grabbing at whatever is immediately in front of your eyes with your gaze. Don't grab, just access the world around you now. Hello, back again, eyes open. For these moments, we've been in sync, and not just our individual selves, but our table groups, and the whole room is fluctuating gently right now. Some of you are able to sense field effects. You all know what it is. You've gone into auditoriums where nothing's been happening on the stage and it's just flat. You walk in and it's just a room, just four walls. Come back into that theater late at night after a rousing performance and you can feel the difference. It's true in churches as well. But anyone can feel this field right now abroad in the room. This is where the heart goes with a little practice, with steady intention, and with positive feelings of some form of love. It yields well-being. It yields demonstrably better health. Physical and psychological repair happen in coherence, and it sends out literally electromagnetic field waves of living energy around us. It's a good way to begin or conclude a prayer time or to start a meeting, but it's particularly good to sit with a grieving or sick friend when you don't know what to say. You don't need to say anything. If you can move into heart coherence organically, silently, you'll bless them into a little more coherence, a little more ease themselves. Well, some of you will say, nice little visualizing exercise, and fun that we actually did that. But some of you will recognize it as a new mode of operating intelligence. HeartMath offers training programs all over the world. Corporations now invite them to come in and use this and a great many much more sophisticated measures. But what's interesting is to look at the annual reports in these corporations that under the heading of management and training very often will run a little pricey after a year of working with HeartMath strategies. They report that the workers are healthier, that their insurance payments are really less, that there is noticeably more cooperation and creativity at work. Several new ideas, one new patent has come out of this. The stress is way down, and the overall working atmosphere has increased efficiency in every sector. Heart-mind coherence for us, however, is a spiritual exercise. When three people are in a coherent state, they naturally pull that fourth non-coherent person into coherence. Doesn't this remind you of something else? When two or three are gathered together in my name, there am I amidst them. I've long thought that an unarticulated reason for people going to church is because it pulls them into order. I don't know if this came up in your brainstorming, but that's what happens in my experience. We've just had a little review that gives you some of the anatomy of what makes that happen. Our little exercise offers a doorway into another level of living, of religious or spiritual life, if we're willing to consider it as a form of Samir's conversion. It's a version of that heart, a version of that heart coherence has become the great teaching of one of today's spiritual visionaries, Brother David Steindl-Rast. He says, "The practice of gratefulness that I'm concerned with is grateful living. That means every moment of your life you practice gratefulness. You practice awareness that everything is gift, everything is gratuitous. And if it's all given, it's gratuitously given, then the only appropriate response is gratefulness. What we really want is joy. We don't want things. Yet, we cannot be grateful for war. That's an unmitigated evil. We cannot be grateful for exploitation, for untimely death. But we can be grateful in every situation for what the opportunity is which that situation provides. There's always an opportunity for something positive. Usually the opportunity to learn something new, even in the worst situations, or for the opportunity to do something." Well, Brother David is often spoken of as a global spirit. It's literally true, I think. He now lives in a steadily coherent heart and mind state. Any of you who have had the opportunity to be in his presence have had an experience of that coherence. And as we know now, that appreciation and gratitude have literal energetic power, radiating out endlessly when they're sustained in that steady, positive state, which is what he's given his life to demonstrating. So I like to imagine for a minute that here we all were just sending out our small, steady signals. We know that his steady signals are abroad, everywhere. I like to think that we have shaken hands this morning, that we have touched briefly into a part of Steindl-Rast's field. Well, when with increasing ability to sustain this kind of heart mindfulness, we tap into a range of wholeness that Joseph Campbell described in his own depth work with the soul of the world. The goal of life is to make your heartbeat match the beat of the universe and to match your nature with your nature with nature. The New Age notion of Gaia as a living entity, a whole living entity, becomes a part of this living kingdom of peace. This God of all existence that Samir is talking about. With this coherent state, you'll find we can begin to sense into the animal mind. We can begin to sense into some of the living patterns of intelligence in water, in the animal kingdom, in plants. It's quite an extraordinary journey that consciousness is beginning to go on. In times of emergency, then, to sum up, we are always signaled by a call to arms. You can think of a Robin Hood. But we're now living in another state of emergency with a very different call to arms. The emergence of Diana Butler Bass's fourth great awakening. The emergent church that makes relatives of all religions because they stem from the same root. Interfaith work isn't happening only in New York City. It's abroad here in Santa Barbara. I've seen some of you up at Casa de Maria doing it together. An emergent spirituality that is arising powerfully within the whole culture, both secular and sacred, is creating this conversion, Samir's word. The call to link arms to bring this emergence forth is heard by groups like this one in our last slide, mostly small groups who are self-organizing into meditation groups, healing groups, circles of trust groups, coherence groups, supporting each other and being truthful, and in establishing a steady state of coherence. The morning's glimpse into the research of heart-mind coherence offers us some new dimensions and implications of Jesus' teachings to do just that. So I think that Samir wouldn't mind letting Ram Dass have the last word this morning. He says, "Remember, we are all affecting the world every moment, whether we mean to or not. Our actions and states of mind matter because we're so deeply interconnected with one another. Working on our own consciousness is the most important thing that we are doing at any moment. And being love, heart coherence, is the supreme creative act." Thank you.